everybody, my name is Ken Fallon, and today I want to talk to you about my journey in migrating away from Google Reader. Google Reader is one of the best applications out there. It's definitely one of the best services provided by Google. And what it is essentially is a way that you can subscribe to a newsfeed. If you don't know what that is, it's like a blog posting or whatever. And rather than having to revisit the site every time something is posted, what they do is they update the RSS, which really simple syndication feed, which is nothing more than an XML file. And your reader, your client, RSS reader, goes out and connects to those feeds and downloads only the new items that have changed. So places like the BBC or CNN or whoever have these feeds, and you can read their news items without actually having to go to their websites. Or you can go to the websites by clicking on the link. It's very useful and very convenient thing. One disadvantage over the traditional applications that you would have on your Linux PC or your Windows PC or your mobile phone is the synchronization of what you've read. So in a typical situation, you might wake up in the morning, check your news feeds at home, then go on to the train, check some more feeds there, and then during your lunch break, you might check some more feeds at work. And what's really convenient about Google Reader is that the feeds that you've marked as read on one location are marked as read in all the other locations. The one thing that did concern me a little bit about Google Reader was the fact that the idea of somebody looking over your shoulder. Now, remember, everybody, when you were younger and you would lean over your grandpa's shoulder and start reading the newspaper, to which he, in my case, would roll it up and slap you across the head with it in a friendly fashion, saying it was rude to do that. And yet, at the same time, we're allowing complete strangers to look into what we're reading. Now, it's, you know, a common thing on the train to identify people's political affiliation by the newspaper that they subscribe to. And in the same way, you can determine a lot by somebody's news feeds that they subscribe to. For example, the news feeds that I subscribe to contain a lot of news sites, BBC for instance. I also subscribe to Dutch sites, Irish news sites, and German news sites. But to get a balanced opinion, I also subscribe to Al Jazeera. So what I noticed was, once I expanded my list feeds that I started subscribing to, I noticed that certain things started changing in my search patterns. And I want to play this this speech, TED Talk, by Elie Parseer, entitled "Beware of Online Filter Bubbles." It was a TED Talk, and it was watched currently over nearly 1.5 million times. So I'll just splice that in here. It's, of course, released under the Creative Commons by attribution, non-commercial, share-alike license. So it's TED Talk, and a link will be available in the show notes. Enjoy.
Mark Zuckerberg, a journalist, was asking him a question about the news feed. And the journalist was asking him, you know, why is this so important? And Zuckerberg said, a squirrel dying in your front yard may be more relevant to your interests right now than people dying in Africa. And I want to talk about what a web based on that idea of relevance might look like. So when I was growing up in a really rural area in Maine, you know, the internet meant something very different to me. It meant a connection to the world. It meant something that would connect us all together. And I was sure that it was going to be great for democracy and for our society. But there's this kind of shift in how information is flowing online. And it's invisible. And if we don't pay attention to it, it could be a real problem. So I first noticed this in a place I spend a lot of time, my Facebook page. I'm progressive politically, big surprise, but I've always gone out of my way to meet conservatives. I like hearing what they're thinking about. I like seeing what they link to. I like learning a thing or two. And so I was kind of surprised when I noticed one day that the conservatives had disappeared from my Facebook feed. And what it turned out was going on was that Facebook was looking at which links I clicked on. And it was noticing that actually I was clicking more on my liberal friends' links than on my conservative friends' links. And without consulting me about it, it had edited them out. They disappeared. So Facebook isn't the only place that's doing this kind of invisible algorithmic editing of the web. Google's doing it too. If I search for something and you search for something, even right now at the very same time, we may get very different search results. Even if you're logged out, one engineer told me, there are 57 signals that Google looks at. Everything from what kind of computer you're on, to what kind of browser you're using, to where you're located, that it uses to personally tailor your query results. Think about it for a second. There is no standard Google anymore. And you know, the funny thing about this is that it's hard to see. You can't see how different your search results are from anyone else's. But a couple of weeks ago, I asked a bunch of friends to Google Egypt and to send me screenshots of what they got. So here's my friend Scott's screenshot, and here's my friend Daniel's screenshot. When you put them side by side, you don't even have to read the links to see how different these two pages are. But when you do read the links, it's really quite remarkable. Daniel didn't get anything about the protests in Egypt at all in his first page of Google results. Scott's results were full of them. And this was the big story of the day at that time. That's how different these results are becoming. So it's not just Google and Facebook either. You know, this is something that's sweeping the web. There are a whole host of companies that are doing this kind of personalization. Yahoo News, the biggest news site on the internet, is now personalized. Different people get different things. Huffington Post, Washington Post, New York Times, all flirting with personalization in various ways. And where this moves us very quickly toward a world in which the internet is showing us what it thinks we want to see, but not necessarily what we need to see. As Eric Schmidt said, it'll be very hard for people to watch or consume something that has not, in some sense, been tailored for them. So I do think this is a problem. And I think if you take all of these filters together, if you take all of these algorithms, you get what I call a filter bubble. And your filter bubble is kind of your own personal, unique universe of information that you live in online. And what's in your filter bubble depends on who you are, and it depends on what you do. But the thing is that you don't decide what gets in. And more importantly, you don't actually see what gets edited out. So one of the problems with the filter bubble was discovered by some researchers at Netflix. And they were looking at the Netflix queues, and they noticed something kind of funny that a lot of us probably have noticed, which is there are some movies that just sort of zip right up and out to our houses. They enter the queue, they just zip right out. So Iron Man zips right out, right? And waiting for Superman can wait for a really long time. What they discovered was that in our Netflix queues, there's kind of this epic struggle going on between our future aspirational selves and our more impulsive present selves. You know, we all want to be someone who has watched Rashomon. But right now, we want to watch Ace Ventura for the fourth time. So the best editing gives us a bit of both. It gives us a little bit of Justin Bieber and a little bit of Afghanistan. It gives us some information vegetables. It gives us some information dessert. And the challenge with these kind of algorithmic filters, these personalized filters, is that because they're mainly looking at what you click on first, you know, it can throw off that balance. And instead of a balanced information diet, you can end up surrounded by information junk food. So what this suggests is actually that we may have the story about the internet wrong. In a broadcast society, you know, this is how the founding mythology goes, right? In a broadcast society, there were these gatekeepers, the editors, and they controlled the flows of information. And along came the internet, and it swept them out of the way, and it allowed us, all of us, to connect together, and it was awesome. But that's not actually what's happening right now. What we're seeing is more of a passing of the torch from human gatekeepers to algorithmic ones. And the thing is that the algorithms don't yet have the kind of embedded ethics that the editors did. So if algorithms are going to curate the world for us, if they're going to decide what we get to see and what we don't get to see, then we need to make sure that they're not just keyed to relevance. We need to make sure that they also show us things that are uncomfortable or challenging or important. This is what TED does, right? Other points of view. And the thing is, we've actually kind of been here before as a society. In 1915, it's not like newspapers were sweating a lot about their civic responsibilities. Then people kind of noticed that they were doing something really important. That in fact, you couldn't have a functioning democracy if citizens didn't get a good flow of information. That the newspapers were critical because they were acting as the filter, and that journalistic ethics developed. It wasn't perfect, but it got us through the last century. And so now, we're kind of back in 1915 on the web. And we need the new gatekeepers to encode that kind of responsibility into the code that they're writing. You know, I know there are a lot of people here from Facebook and from Google, Larry and Sergey, who, you know, people who have helped build the web as it is, and I'm grateful for that. But we really need you to make sure that these algorithms have encoded in them a sense of the public life, a sense of civic responsibility. We need you to make sure that they're transparent enough that we can see what the rules are that determine what gets through our filters. And we need you to give us some control so that we can decide what gets through and what doesn't. Because I think we really need the internet to be that thing that we all dreamed of it being. We need it to connect us all together. We need it to introduce us to new ideas and new people, and different perspectives. And it's not going to do that if it leaves us all isolated in a web of one. Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, so we've decided that we want to move off Google Reader. What do we need to do? Well, the first thing we need to do is get a list of the feeds. And in fairness to Google, they make this very easy to do. They have a team called the Data Liberation Team within Google, and their goal is from the website dataliberation.org. Users should be able to control the data they store in any of Google's products. Our team's goal is to make it easier to move data in and out. So all you need to do is open up Reader, go to Settings, Reader settings, import and export, and right there you will have an OPML file for you. An OPML is an online processor markup language. So it's XML format, and it basically describes a list of RSS feeds for you. You don't need to worry too much about that, just because I've got a fetish for XML files. You don't need to get caught up in that. So, now that we've got our feed, the question is, how are we going to use that feed? Are we just going to simply load it onto our different feed readers and be back into the same problem that we had before, not things not being synchronized? Well, there is an obvious solution, actually, when you think about it, of things reading messages in one location and having them synchronized across the other locations. And that, of course, is the IMAP protocol. From Wikipedia again, the Internet Message Access Protocol, IMAP, is one of the most prevalent internet standard protocols for email retrieval, the other being Post Office Protocol, POP. Virtually all modern email clients and servers support both protocols as a means of transporting email messages from a server. So, what it does essentially is, if you mark a message deleted on one mailbox, when you check on the other mailbox, it's also deleted. IMAP also supports a cool thing called offline mailboxes, so you can download your messages to an offline store. And this is super convenient. It's based on certain clients and actually offers functionality that Google doesn't provide. Now, on my train trip home, the journey passes. It's at a very busy time and it passes through one of the largest business districts. And I have a very, very poor signal the whole way home. And often I got frustrated waiting for Google Reader to work. But now, downloading my messages in IMAP, I can have them already downloaded and stored on my laptop or my mobile device ready to go. So, IMAP is supported by basically everything. Even Microsoft Outlook supports it on Linux, Thunderbird, Evolution, KML and Claws all support it. There's Android clients, iPhone clients, Windows Mobile clients. There's also, if you like the whole concept of webmail, there's most service providers provide something like Squirrel Mail or something like that to allow you to access IMAP via a website. So even if you're away from a client and you're at a internet cafe, you can still connect to your news feeds. And on any of these devices, if you mark your messages as read or deleted, then it's read or deleted. And if you want to share it with somebody, you just press forward and email it on to somebody else. It's kind of cool. So I was faced then with I had my list of feeds and I knew where I wanted to put them. The only thing was how I was going to get from one to the other. And a quick DuckDuckGo search led me to feed to IMAP. That's F-E-E-D, the numeral 2, and IMAP. And the homepage is home.gna.org/feed-to-imap. And from their website, Feed to IMAP is an RSS Atom feed aggregator. After downloading feeds over HTTP or HTTPS, it uploads them to a specified folder on an IMAP mail server and copies them to a local mail deer. The user can then access the feeds using Mutt, Evolution, Mozilla, Thunderbird, or even a webmail client. The application's been out for a while, and it's in all major repositories. I had it up and running in about 10 minutes, and the configuration file is kept in a hidden file in your home directory called .feed2imaprc. And it's a fairly simple configuration file. It's based on yet another markup language, if you're into text file markup languages. And so a simple feed might be consist of minimum of 3 lines, possibly 4, and you can add more items in there. You can even add the ability to download the feed and modify it in some way before you process it. If you open up the feed to IMAP RC example, you will see various different ways to utilize it. So what you require is, first of all, a name, and that's just, for example, kenfallon.com is the name of one of my feeds. The URL is http://kenfallon.com/?feed2RSS. So that's the RSS feed itself coming from Google Reader. The target then is your IMAP location. So it's IMAP:// and the username :/server. And then wherever you want to put it. If you've got the @, you need to escape it with the percent character and then the ASCII field. I chose to put my feeds into inbox.fields, and then I made subfolders for every group that I had already defined within Google Reader. And the only other options I set was include-images to be true. So I wrote an actual little Perl script to take an OPML file and convert it into a configuration file, a feed to IMAP RC file. And so I didn't want to be doing that again, so I wrote that there. And thanks to Klaatu over at GNU World Order, it's an episode on Git, March 31st, 2010, episode Season 7, episode 13. The code is available for everybody to download at gitorius.org/opml2feed. So once you've done that, you now have a .feed2imaprc file in your home directory hidden. And the next thing you should do is go over to your email client and set up the RSS account. I set up a simple throwaway account that I limited to 100 megabytes or whatever, so that if I forget to check my feed for a while, it won't start encroaching on other users. And actually, when I uploaded this the first time, I posted the link into the Ogcast Planet RSS, IRC channel, sorry, the IRC channel, and Cprompt called me aside to say, oh, did you realize that you have your RSS username and password in the file, so for your IMAP folder, which when you think about it, actually, I initially panicked and then I thought, well, you know, here are people I know looking over my shoulder, so I have nothing to hide in there. The only reason I'm not putting it into this show or the show notes is that I don't want it used as a means for spammers. But at least there, I know the people who were in the channel at the time. And of course, I can change the username and password if I wish. So once you do that, you should be all set. All you need to do is run feed to IMAP. And on your email client, you should start seeing the messages starting to appear. And if you mark them red on one client, you should see them also being marked as red on the other clients. I simply used Cron to schedule the feed to IMAP to run every 2 hours at 40 minutes past the hour. And that's pretty much it. I've been using it for about a week now. It works out very, very well. It's supported by the standard IMAP client on my phone. I've started using Claw's email client on my on all my machines, actually, because it supports this really well and is a nice, simple, straightforward client. I did use it on Thunderbird, and I also used it on KMail. And just to check, I installed it, checked it out on Microsoft Outlook, and it works on all of them. So, all in all, quite a good a nice success there. And so if you are considering an alternative to Google for search, I've also been using DuckDuckGo for a while, so that's a good alternative to that. And if you're looking for an alternative to Google Reader, then Feed to IMAP is a nice alternative that you can take the whole functioning of what you're reading to keep it a little bit more private if you wish, or not. If you don't, you simply publish your username and password on a website, disabling sending, of course. So that's it. Thank you very much for listening. Hope you got something from this. There will be detailed show notes in the episode for this, and also over on my own website, kenfallon.com. If you have considered it, please consider recording a show here for Hacker Public Radio. We'd really appreciate it. Okay, thank you, and tune in tomorrow for something completely different.
You have been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by a HBR listener like yourself. If you ever considered recording a podcast, then visit our website to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club. HBR is funded by the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. All Binrev projects are proudly sponsored by Lunar Pages. From shared hosting to custom private clouds, go to lunarpages.com for all your hosting needs. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.0 license.